So like maybe if giant robot combat becomes the way that disputes are resolved in the world, like maybe that gets us there.
A lot of my little Transformer and fans may agree with you on that.
Exactly. Beam sword. I'm about that. That'd be awesome.
Beam swords. Let's do this.
Like, maybe that's how we do it. Maybe that's how we get lightsabers.
Welcome to Death Watch, the Star Wars podcast from a galaxy not so far away. I'm Chris Skull. Today we'll be talking about what is probably the most iconic and, in my opinion, the coolest part of Star Wars, lightsabers. We're joined today by Alan White, who knows a thing or two about lightsabers since he makes them and he teaches people how to use them. How you doing, Alan?
I'm doing awesome. I'm glad that you had an unexpected cancellation, so we get to do this today.
No, thanks for jumping on at the last minute. We typically, when we have our guests on board, we ask them, like, for instance, how did you get into Star Wars? What do you like about it? I think an icebreaker question that I have for you is, what are your top three favorite movies? And then what's your least favorite movie? And why is it The Last Jedi?
No. We're going to start fighting right from jump?
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was great having you on the show, Alan. That's it for this episode of Death Watch.
So my top three,
yeah,
are
you're gonna say it. I know, just say it, man.
I realize that it's Knuckles and Jawbone's time here in a second, but my top three are The Last Jedi,
yeah,
Empire, and then New Hope.
Awesome.
And for the most part in that order.
Yeah, I mean, Mike and I famously are not fans of The Last Jedi at all, but I do have to, you know, I can't help but see that it's like there's a diametric split in the fandom when it comes to whether people, you know, like, they either love the movie or they absolutely hated it. And I think it's very interesting how that it's gotten that kind of a reaction. But for everything that I've seen regarding The Last Jedi, or rather I've heard from fans of The Last Jedi, is you know, there's a lot of convincing points regarding, you know, metaphors and symbolism and things like that.
Well, it depends on what you like from Star Wars, what you're going to love about different movies. And so like the people that dislike The Last Jedi, as an example, are usually coming from a lot of different perspectives. But one of the things that's unique about their dislike is, even if they're disliking it for different reasons, a lot of times their center of dislike arrives on like similar characters or similar points. Mm-hmm. Whereas like previous movies, you know, there would be different people that disliked different movies for different reasons, but the things that they would dislike would be very separate. Mm-hmm. You know, like when we look back on Phantom Menace and then the prequels in general, like Jar Jar is a huge focus of animosity.
Yeah.
And it's because there are people that dislike Jar Jar for different reasons, but there's this locus of that dislike. Mm-hmm. And so The Last Jedi has a lot of those things as well. And that's an aspect of storytelling in general is, and truthfully, like The Rise of Skywalker, you can see, especially if you sort of, if you describe the dislike of The Last Jedi in that way, where the people that disliked it for different reasons, but had similar points of emphasis for their dislike.
Yeah.
Right. The Rise of Skywalker, you can see from storytelling decisions that there appeared to be a pretty conscious effort to scatter the dislike.
Yeah, I agree.
It
was felt pretty obvious that they were backpedaling on a lot of different things.
Well, and it was more like, I think they were trying to thread the needle between the sort of the polarized fans to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And I understand why they did it. To me, it felt like a greatest hits album.
I haven't heard it described that way, but I get it.
It's like nail on the head, right? It's just cause a greatest hits album, like, and this is why it's sort of the ideal description, in my opinion. A greatest hits album is never going to be somebody's favorite album from a band.
Yeah.
But it is never going to be their least favorite. It's never going to be the one that they dunk on the most.
because it touches the points that we as fans appreciated the most about it. It was right. It did feel like it was trying to get a little bit of everybody at the end, and then, you know, of course there's a challenge as you have to conclude the story.
Yeah,
it's the last of the trilogy, so that you have to conclude it in some manner, and not right. everybody's going to be completely satisfied with it. I do agree with you in that regard. Let's talk a little bit about what you do with your company, Level Up Lightsabers.
Nice pivot.
Actually, before we go on, what's been your least favorite movie from the Star Wars universe?
And that's what makes the sequel sort of difficult for me, because in a lot of ways, The Rise of Skywalker is the one that was the most disappointing. Because like, I mean, Attack of the Clones is one of the most common answers among people that don't say The Last Jedi. But the Rise of Skywalker to me felt very like it had moments, like the poignant moments, the stuff that was supposed to be emotional and the stuff that was supposed to hit, it absolutely hit, you know, like this stuff for Carrie and honoring her and honoring Leia and some of those things, like they, you know, it had some really, really beautiful things, but like as somebody that really appreciated how brave they were trying to be with The Last Jedi, and also we won't have to dive into this, but like the arc that I felt like The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi set up, The Rise of Skywalker felt like a really hard pivot off of that in order to make a greatest hits album that was otherwise kind of uninspiring.
Which specific arc are you referring to?
There's a lot of stuff to this. I'm happy to dive into it, but
actually do have an episode planned for talking about The Last Jedi, you know, down the line.
The two biggest things, and I can short Cliff's Notes these. So like what I felt like the arc for Finn that was set up between the two movies, and you may not necessarily agree, and a lot of people may not necessarily agree. But the first movie, Finn's sort of dominant competing emotions are fear, but also this sort of desire to help. Mm-hmm. Friends, right? And yeah, so like there's this
is obvious, it's there,
and it's but like the fear is the dominant antagonistic emotion. Okay. Yeah. And now The Last Jedi, and one of the scenes that a lot of people that dislike Last Jedi, one of the things they dislike is Finn making his run at the cannon and being stopped, and mm-hmm. that moment for me, the dominant antagonistic emotion was anger. Mm-hmm. And so if we go back to Yoda from Empire Strikes Back, right? Fear leads to anger,
and then anger leads to hate,
right? And but the anger was interrupted, and so what I felt like the concluding arc for Finn, what I felt like it was going to be, was basically taking the Jedi's path, because like that was him facing the dark side choice and choosing against, because all of our Jedi and all of our heroes in general are faced with some combination of fear, anger, and then lust for power. Mm-hmm. And so like Anakin's fall was initiated by fear, mm-hmm. like the fear of loss and because of attachment. And then that led him to this path of anger and feeling betrayed and committing betrayal that he justified because he felt betrayed and all this sort of stuff. Right. Yeah. And so like we saw Anakin confronted with these choices and then fall to the dark side. We saw Luke confronted with these choices and turn away from that same negativity. In The Last Jedi, you know, we see Rey being confronted with those choices from one direction. But we got to see Finn go through this same series of choices. And I was really excited for what I felt like was set up of him being sort of the leader of an uprising, which like we got a little bit of that thread, but I think it was very different from what was pitched to him when he took the role based on interviews that he's done since and some stuff like that.
Yeah. I feel like there were decisions made in the background that did a great disservice to him as a character, as an actor, but then also as the character and how it could have been more fulfilling. But that's, and you know,
again, another time. Right.
This is definitely a conversation for another time.
But that's
But thanks for that though. And I do appreciate, you know, hearing from that side of the aisle, so to speak, as to why the sequels in general, you know, compared to original trilogy fans like Mike and myself, you know, you have these expectations when the movies come in and you don't want it to be obvious fan service, but you also don't want the writers and the storytellers to do a great disservice to the universe that you fell in love with.
Right.
You know, so not everyone is ever going to be happy with those decisions. So I just find it interesting how it's become divisive. Of course, I don't like the fact that people have been as aggressive as they are with that divisiveness. Rather, I'm open for debate and conversation, because once you pull these responses, everybody gets to see on the table, what is it that we don't like? What is it that we do like? And then that pushes storytelling and the responsibility that writers and storytellers have, because we're paying you money to entertain us. We're paying you to build the universe for us. So I feel like as fans, we do have the responsibility of, you know, pointing out what are the faults and what are the pros, the positives of it, but doing so in a civil manner, so that everybody can still, you know, enjoy this universe that's been built for our benefit.
Well, and also respecting each other, like as fans.
Yeah.
Like this is not an indictment of you or an indictment of people that dislike the sequels. But like I did a TikTok last week where I dared to utter that Rey is a Skywalker. And I realized that stating the fact that that is canon is like poking a bear with a hornet's nest. Yeah. And I understand that. But one of the things that is a reality of our society right now, like outside of just being a Star Wars fan, but like society, we're very polarized. And the polarization lends us towards creating teams that every now and then there will be people on your side of a team that you don't ideologically agree with on anything else.
It's like, I don't know if there's a specific term for it, but I call it basically the Super Bowl mentality. It's either my team or your team, and then no one else matters.
Tribalism
in between.
Is the word
essentially.
But like,
why don't we talk a little bit about what you guys do with?
You're good. Let's roll, because this is also for another conversation, which hopefully I will get to do.
Level up light.
Yeah.
So you've told me before that not only do you provide lightsabers and custom lightsabers for people who are obviously fans of having a lightsaber, but you also train people how to wield them.
Actually I've got to correct you on a couple of things. So like custom is, so like if somebody advertises that they are custom, and this is the reason why I don't advertise that I am custom. If somebody advertises that they are custom, what that says, if somebody tells me that they are custom, is that they are making the product to order. And
that's true.
And so
from a small shop perspective, I know that, and I've stopped taking custom orders specifically for that reason.
And so I have products that I use from, I'm working with a manufacturer that serves a tremendous portion of the market. There are a lot of companies that sell stuff that's going to look a lot like mine, because we're using the same factory. And that's also why, so like, even though a lot of features on the saber are customizable, I avoid using the word customizable as well, because there are a lot of people that will hear custom and then they have an assumption that may not necessarily be what I do, and I don't want to mislead people.
I understand.
But so like the sabers that I sell are customizable at home. And so hopefully that doesn't get taken out of context and then give somebody the wrong impression. But
they have interchangeable components.
Yeah. And so everything on the training site uses the same gauge and the same threading. So if you have more than one, you can literally completely disassemble them and then reassemble them in any order you want.
I gotcha. That's pretty convenient.
It's really handy. And then it also makes it so that if you wanted to like make a staff saber or a double-ended saber or whatever, you don't have to buy two sabers at the same time. You can buy one, and then several months later, you can buy a different one, and they don't have to be the same color. They don't have to be the same style. They're still going to connect, and you still get that.
That's very different from like the Disney model. I've never actually been to the Savvy.
I haven't gotten to hold one of their one of the Savvy ones yet. Yeah.
I'm sure you can, but it's, I don't know how tough it is to actually get new parts and replace the parts. You know, I know it's a process as part of the story.
Yeah,
I would much prefer something I'm paying this money. I would much rather have the option that if I want to change it up and switch out certain components, I have the freedom to be able to do so. And I feel like that's the real appeal to getting a lightsaber. But then you also train people.
Yeah.
How do you use it correctly?
And so I actually started out, so I've only been selling since the end of October. My training site has been up since 2016. and it was one of the challenges that we had of helping people get signed up for the training site was that many people had trouble getting lightsabers that were suitable for training at a price point that fit. Right. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, gave them the ability to kind of like, all right, I'm going to invest in a saber. I don't have, you know, the $500 to get this, you know, movie realistic NeoPixel, incredibly customizable. Yeah. Like I don't have the money to do that. And if I just spent the money on a lightsaber like that, I really don't want to be outside or in a building beating it against things. Because it's like I use it for different stuff.
Yeah.
And so,
although I have literally seen your students take a lightsaber and then beat blocks of concrete with it.
That was a lot of fun. That afternoon was a lot of fun.
I can imagine.
I wanted, and I was trying to beat that particular blade to the point of failure. And it rattled itself loose from the handle and I didn't have the correct hex key to tighten it back in.
We call it stress testing.
Yes, yes. And so like I had to stop. I didn't like after 60 blows, I had to stop because the blade came out and I didn't have the tool to put it back in, but I still hadn't actually broken it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty reasonable that you have something that's, you know, essentially a prop weapon, even though it's very durable.
Yeah.
You know, it's not to diminish its quality, but you have something that's essentially a prop weapon. If you use it against, let's say, a person 60 times, I mean, first of all, you shouldn't have been using it one time because after one time, that's called
assault at that point. Yeah, assault with a weapon.
At that point, if you get hit with it 60 times, then at that point, yes, you definitely do need to know how to defend yourself against the lightsaber.
COVID happened, and that has been very hard on my martial arts school, and also been, you know, challenging for the lightsaber program, because if it's hard to meet people to practice, then like that,
of course,
right? So that's, you know, the fitness industry in general has been hit very hard the last year. Excuse me. And so that gave me the opportunity, because all of a sudden I was teaching fewer classes and stuff like that. It gave me the opportunity to research manufacturers for sabers. And I'd done this once back in 2017 and hadn't really been able to turn up something that made a saber I was happy with at a price point that I was happy with that made sense. And
it could take a long time to just, you know, try to source the right material.
Yeah. And so then I took another crack at it and the world is different now. Like, you know, dramatically so. And I was able to, you know, get some test sabers from a couple of different companies, find something that I was happy with, find a couple of some things that I was happy with, develop a good relationship with that manufacturer. And so their product is what I'm carrying. You know, and then, I'm able to do customer support because if somebody receives a product that's got some kind of a problem, maybe it's a, you know, something's wrong with the battery or something happens to the electronics in transit or whatever, like I can fix it and I can fix it really quickly. Whereas if they had ordered it from, you know, AliExpress is one of the common things that people sort of point to. Cause you can find a lot of things very inexpensive on AliExpress.
Yeah, no kidding.
But if you need customer service, it becomes a lot more difficult because like there's time zone differences and language barriers and other stuff like that.
If it exists at all.
Also, which is another thing I don't like to like, it's a very easy criticism to levy, but it's also not universally true. So I don't want to give people I don't want to misrepresent.
I say this from personal experience.
I'm sure.
Customer service, especially from a small shop, is incredibly important.
Yes.
I mean, how many times we've been able to salvage a sale or be able to rectify the I guess the satisfaction of a customer simply by just being able to communicate, and then and even hearing from our competitors with a lack of customer service or an unwillingness to communicate how dissatisfied many customers are, and eventually, and sometimes they've come to us. So I love the fact that not only do you, your business model is, yes, you provide the thing, but then you you train people to use the thing. And it's a, it seems to me like it's a pretty great outlet, especially, what was the primary age for your students, you said, or the average age for your students?
It sort of fluctuates. Like, so like I start as young as 11. My youngest student currently is 12. But mostly it's like, you know, kids that are in sort of late high school and then also adults. And a lot of them tend to be in their early 20s because they're as an adult in my late 30s, who is also a father, I have to be really, really selective about what things I do with my free time, because being a dad and being a husband, there's a lot of things that are, you know, my responsibility to take care of. And I have to be, you know, and so I haven't found as many adults in that age group that sort of have the luxury of being able to start something new that's class-based like that. And one of the nice parts about the online curriculum is it gives people in that position the freedom to sort of undertake it without having to be bound to a class schedule or an appearance schedule. Like, it's something that they can work, you know, from home.
Or in this case, like during a pandemic,
exactly.
Like a personal trainer or coach in front of you. You have the sort of pay as you go. You have a train as you go sort of method. And then there's also the remote training options as well. I'm really glad that you guys have been able to figure it out given the circumstances. But at the same time, you guys are actually helping people sort of flourish this love and appreciation for the Star Wars lore that we've all come to know and appreciate.
And
so thanks for that.
No, absolutely. And one of the, as a martial arts instructor, I sort of approach delivering curriculum a little differently. A lot of the free resources that are available online, people are, from a training standpoint, they're really focused on the canon, like the forms as they've been described through some of the canon manuals over the years and books and things like that. And those are all, like, they're all sort of based on sword styles and martial arts from our own, you know, Earth history. But the teaching isn't necessarily grounded in giving people fundamentals. It's a lot of times it's more about sort of teaching the forms and teaching the ness of the forms. And if you've got a martial arts background, you can dive into something like that, and like your barrier to get going isn't that high. If you don't have a martial arts background, or you don't have something that gives you sort of the foundational principles, it's really hard to start that way. You know, it's like learning a foreign language. And if you don't have vocabulary, if you don't have, you know, even the alphabet, it can be really, really difficult to follow that language. And so that's been sort of my approach, is rather than focusing on the forms as they're presented in the books, it's more about, here's some principles. These are the triangles. This is how the triangles work. Build your style. Like, don't build mine. Don't copy me. Don't copy somebody else's. Cause the way to be the most effective you is to be you. And so if you're trying to be someone else, their body works differently than you. Yeah. And so you can take principles, you can take elements, and you can learn from what they do. But ultimately what you want to do with a martial art is learn yourself, and be balanced and be powerful and understand the geometry and things like that. But then, you know, ultimately the rules exist so that you think about them before you break them. And it doesn't, you know, it's like the lines in the road, like they're just paint. And so if we all ignored them all the time, that would be bad. But every now and then you'll be in a situation where it makes sense to ignore the lines in the road.
You gotta deviate.
You know, and that's...
Yeah, like we were going to talk a little bit more about forms in a bit, but I've noticed that even when it comes to the seven forms of lightsaber combat, there were variations. And Mace Windu was made most famous for his use of the seventh form of Vapad, which is a variation. And I do appreciate that when you're training your students, you know, yes, there is pretty much a lot of information on the seven forms of lightsaber combat, but this is still the real world, and you're still abiding by different different body types and combat experience, whether they be more advanced or have zero experience. You know, it's about being able to utilize it to the best of their abilities, right, and just go
for it. Body mechanics or body mechanics. Like that's exactly. Like nobody's elbow moves in the way that a digital puppet's elbow can move.
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or people who have like on site, you know, paid choreographers and people who have decades of experience, right, being able to show you how to do it, and you're getting paid, you know, it's different.
Exactly.
You're doing this for fun. Exactly. So exactly. So why don't we go into a little bit of the history of lightsabers? Yeah. Because we've known them, you know, in canon, and a lot more has been developed in the previous legends. In the storyline, they've been around for a while in some form, but not necessarily always in the form that we recognize them. What do you know? Do you know anything about the history of the lightsabers?
So, the meta, rather than the lore, has always been the part that was more interesting to me. Truthfully, because the my love of Star Wars and being a martial artist are very, very intertwined. Like I took my first class when I was 10, right before I turned 11. You know, and becoming a Star Wars fan, you know, was sort of like, I started loving Star Wars before that, but in terms of like interacting with the lore and things like that, that sort of started then and progressed as well. And so
when you were in martial art, which form of martial arts did you train in when you were younger?
Well, and so that actually hasn't changed. So my root martial art is called Shaolin Kempo Karate. And it's basically a whole bunch of stuff swizzled up into a blender. And when I tell people that...
Kempo or Kendo?
Kempo, K-E-M-P-O.
Okay.
And so when I tell people that it's this combined integrated style, a lot of people then go, oh, it's a mixed martial art. And like definitionally speaking, that's true. Mm. But what people assume they're going to see when they hear mixed martial art is very different from what I do. With my students, yeah, you know, with my students, most of the time we say karate, because, yeah, you know, for a 7-year-old, that's a word that they identify, you know, and then we get more into the history of our system as they progress, if they get to a level where, you know, it becomes relevant. And so rather than like, you know, inundating somebody with sort of a dogmatic, this is what we are, this is where we come from, all that kind of stuff, it's more like I'm gonna give them stuff, and then if they're here long enough, yeah, that they decide they're interested in the lore aspect, then we get into that, right? Okay. And now,
yeah, because how my question was how did that your love of Star Wars, how did it affect you in your progression of your training?
Well, and then ultimately I've dabbled in a lot of stuff since starting the Shaolin Kempo, right? I've done, you know, a couple of years of Aikido, which incorporates a lot of, it's sort of a new interpretation on the samurai, was the genesis of that martial art. Mm-hmm. And so there's one aspect of Aikido curriculum is often called Aikiken or Aikido sword. And that's been a partial influence on my sword curriculum. I realize I look it. My grandmother's originally Okinawan. And so
yeah, it's super obvious.
For, yeah, me. I'm a quarter Japanese. It's my left leg. I like
how you made the determination. It was your left and not your right leg. I don't want to know.
Better balance. that's a gag I've been using since I was 19. Like, you know, some jokes just like some jokes are 2 decades old and then you lean into it.
see what you did there.
But that's that's an aspect as well. And so I've done a lot of different samurai sword training, because there's like lots of different mm-hmm. families of sword training and lots of different eras of sword styles. Mm-hmm. And so like that's all sort of influenced my saber curriculum, along with there is a whole family of Philippine martial arts. People, sometimes it's called FMA or Kali or Arnis or Eskrima, that is like variable weapon geometric sort of stuff. And so there's a lot of that kind of built into my drills and system as well. But that's all things that I have done over the years because I found it interesting. And then once I had the opportunity to start teaching a sword class, that was sort of rooted in, the Memoto family, which is, my grandmother's maiden name. I had a lot of trouble keeping consistent students. If I handed them a wooden sword and say, pretend this is a sword, pretend you're a samurai. Okay. Exactly. And so like I hand somebody a boken and say, pretend this is a sword. Some people could do that. Most people, it was like, well, you know, whatever. As soon as I handed somebody an expensive flashlight and said, pretend this is a lightsaber and then pretend that you are a Jedi or a Sith, it didn't matter how old that person was. They had no trouble at all. zero problems.
0% of the time they did not make the sounds effective with it. Like every guaranteed. Exactly. Pretend it's a lightsaber.
First class, everybody has to remember that they don't have to make the noises, right? Like that's and that's one of my favorite, like that's one of my favorite prequel stories, right? Is that they had to keep stopping it. Guys, we're gonna add the sounds in post.
Like I heard about that. I think they did that also for The Last Jedi. I think it was I can't remember her name right now, but the actress who played Holdo, I think she had said that pew, pew, pew. Every time they made the blasters, they had to tell them, you have to stop making the sound. It's going to come on camera. But I get it. I mean, nobody can, I mean, that's part of our culture. Mine, even if you're not a Star Wars fan, you know what a lightsaber is. And that's something
it's so that ubiquitous. Like most, yeah.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. It's just something that everybody knows, regardless of whether you appreciate, you know, deep in the lore, or you're not. Yep. You're not a Star Wars fan at all. But you know, how cool would it be to hold a lightsaber?
Watching Samuel L. Jackson's interviews from the prequels, because he had so much joy. Like I remember, you know, like he smiles like a little kid and goes, "I got to whisper in Yoda's ear." Like you see his facial expression, you hear his tone of voice, and it's like Samuel L. Jackson. Like would be in the conversation of scariest voice to hear on the other end of a phone if your life is being threatened. And yet,
oh my God,
in this moment, in this interview, he's 8. Like, you know, and that's one of the wonderful things.
And because of the fact that he's Sam Jackson, they made it canon that purple was an official color for a lightsaber. Yes. And it wasn't even discussed at that point until George Lucas was on set. And then Sam Jackson just looks at him and is like, "I want a purple lightsaber." And he's like, "Well, the good guys get blue and green and bad guys get red. Well, I want purple." Okay. And then boom, how it became canon.
And that's like the meta, like those stories are the things to me that I've always sort of delighted in. Because the lore always comes after the meta, you know, like the green lightsaber in Return of the Jedi. And we still haven't had like a lightsaber fight scene since then, where somebody is using a lightsaber against a blue sky as a backdrop. Like even in the sequels, like the sky is always gray or overcast. I had heard that
George Lucas made the change in edit to change Luke's lightsaber to green because it couldn't.
Yeah, it didn't show up. Tatooine. And so like that whole, like that big set piece battle, like the blue saber blade didn't show up. And so it was like, all right, we're going to make it green because it was a solution to a problem you know, and then the lore explanation came after the practical solution, which,
of course.
Those things are like, those stories to me were always the things that were more interesting. Now there's other Star Wars fans that they prefer the lore, and I'm not going to tell anybody the best way to love Star Wars, right? Like that's, you know, like if the lore is the part that excites your imagination and brings you joy and everything else, awesome. Like that's what this is for. The last 9 months has sucked enough. We don't need to crap on anybody's joy. You know what I mean? Like we're coming up on a year of has sucked enough.
I agree. Let people have their headcanons, man. Yeah. Just let them be.
And don't need other people to like your headcanon as much as you do. Like,
exactly. You
know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was really interested in when I was doing the research for this for the podcast. I found a couple of things about lightsabers in general that I didn't realize. You know, and like any weapon, even in modern day, there's always a primitive ancient version of it. And I remember back in the KOTOR days, you know, you started off with a vibroblade, right, which is the closest thing to a lightsaber back then, you know, thousands of years before the Battle of Yavin. But then eventually the lightsaber was developed in a more primitive form, but it became a thing. It was the Sith, or the ancient Sith, like the actual species on Korriban, that developed the lightsaber, and they developed the innovations behind it. First, it had like a power pack, and then eventually they were able to figure out with the kyber crystal. But it wasn't until, and then at that point, the more peaceful light side Jedi Order, they were not lightsaber users at all. But eventually they saw that, like, hey, you know, those are bad guys, but I like what they're rocking with. I want that.
Well, it should surprise no one that the Sith were sort of leaders in the arms race, right? That's like, so like in terms of like character motivations and other things, like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Like, they were the one to figure out how to weaponize this. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then the Jedi, I always butcher it. But like that, but then that need to, like, we're going to be the shield. Mm-hmm. And so that then leads to, you know, what we think of as the lightsaber now, and their own, like, their response to that. And then also like the idea of like raising the crystal and the crystal choosing you, and like all that lore is, right, you know, makes for such a wonderful, you know, hero metaphor story arc thing, right? Like, mm-hmm, that's awesome stuff.
Even the idea that the modern, well, the historical idea in our universe of the weapon being an extension of the self, right, is no different in Star Wars. That's where Star Wars, where it pulls, mm-hmm, it from. It just adds to that, where the choosing of the kyber crystal, the building of the lightsaber, and imbuing the kyber crystal to the lightsaber, that was all part of the ritual for a Jedi apprentice. And they couldn't really call themselves a Jedi until they were able to figure out that process. It was part of that process. It was part of their training. Or even how one is knighted into the Order of the Jedi is no different, or is very similar at least, to one how is actually knighted today by royalty. And, you know, you were speaking of Aikido, being a, you know, being a form of the samurai swordsmanship. You know, it's obvious that George Lucas stemmed a lot of inspiration from Kurosawa films back in the day. And you're looking back at the ancient samurai and how they used it. It was less offensive. It was more on the defense. I mean,
there's a complicated story to that. And so like,
can you give me the cliff notes on this?
Yes. One of the ways that, So one of the ways that sword styles are sort of classified is Katsujin Ken and Satsujin Ken. And it's sort of two mindsets. And neither one is better than the other. They are basically just two different strategic modes for conflict. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so one is more of a yan style, or like sort of a yang energy, which is basically, I don't care that there are 10,000 of you between me and that door. I'm getting through that door.
That seems more like the
little bit like more Sith, right?
Form 7,
and, yeah, exactly. Right, because it's that, you know, like it's that mindset, right? And it's mm-hmm. Yang, okay. The Yin is functionally the exact opposite. I don't care that there are 10,000 of you. Everything that matters to me is on the other side of this door, so not a single one of you is so much as going to touch the doorknob.
Okay.
And so like those two styles, like those two sort of families of style, or descriptors, categories, whatever, right? That is samurai sword work. And some, like all of them incorporate aspects of both, but some are going to be more sort of aggressively focused. Some of them are going to be more sort of focused on the patient aspect, and they are ultimate foils for each other. because if you're too patient, then you miss your opportunity and it's over and they got you. Or if you are too aggressive, you create your own undoing. And that's, like, to a certain extent, that's sort of what we see from the movies. In the prequels, the Jedi are too patient. And that's what allows Sidious to, he's always the one driving the action. He's always driving the bus.
Yeah.
Because they're too reactive. They never get to catch up to the action. In the sequels, Sidious undoes himself by, like, he plays his hand in Return of the Jedi and it doesn't go how he thinks it will. Or Maul is sort of the ultimate example of, like, he gets inches from his goal. Like, he's right there. He can touch it. But the anger that is the thing that makes him special is also the thing that causes him to fail because he can't overcome the anger.
Right. And even in that, I actually had read somewhere in novelization that Palpatine disliked Maul's style of literally doing backflips and jumping around. It was giving the enemy too many opportunities. But I think during that sequence versus Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, he was too cocky, and that eventually led to his.
That's part of the metaphor of that character is that the anger and the arrogance are. Like, that's the reason why he can't get what he wants. The anger and the arrogance they're what get him really, really close. But then when he's there in that moment to accomplish his goal, whatever the goal happens to be, he always misses it because of those two things. And that's the metaphor of his arc. He's a lot of Star Wars fans remember Freddie Prinze Jr.'s interview where he says he's Sisyphus. Like, he pushes the rock up the hill and he almost gets there.
Yeah.
And then it goes back down.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's an excellent point, actually. So why don't we make like Darth Maul and cut this episode in half to take a break and hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back. This episode of Death Watch is also brought to you by Skull Square Design Company. We're also huge fans of The Mandalorian, as well as Star Wars in general. And we wanted to share that love by making gifts for our fellow fans of Mando and the Child. Whether you wanted some flair while enjoying your favorite beverage in Oga's Cantina, or wanted to covertly show your support to the Resistance while exploring Batuu, we've got gifts for everybody. And not just Star Wars fans, but Marvel and Disney fans too. Check us out at skullsquared.com or follow us on social media at skullsquared. That's skull with a C, as in,
see y'all real soon!
And we're back. So, Alan, let's talk a second about why is it that we love lightsabers so much in our modern day? Why do you think it is? Why are we fascinated with lightsabers?
There's so many things, right? Like, so, like, kids are captured by it partially because, like, as kids, we love, you know, there's a thing about holding on to something powerful that makes us feel powerful. Mm-hmm. Right? And so there's that. There's also sort of a ingrained hero image of, you know, for a lot of our culture, there's sort of an ingrained hero image of, you know, sort of the knight with a sword or the warrior with a sword. And so, like, that
every culture has some sort of aspect where it stems from that form of the warrior wielding the weapon as part of their history. Like, so taking those elements and putting that into Star Wars is a no-brainer because it's part of our real history. Now, my question is, do you think it's possible that something like a lightsaber in the lore, do you think it's possible to become real?
And so, like, I know at this point, everybody has seen the viral video of he made basically a plasma cutter that just has a super long blade and control blade and is able to, you know, disintegrate things with it. And so, you know, that's something that we've all sort of witnessed in action. That's something we've all seen. And so from, it's got the look, right? You know, it's a blade that just emits light because it's so hot. It's held in your hands, you know, that sort of thing. The limitations on a weapon, because weapons are ultimately designed by people that are having to solve problems that are faced in war. You know, weapons aren't solved by people that are trying to, or created by people that are trying to solve problems that happen in your neighborhood. Not really. It's more, you know, stuff that is happening in war. And then if those things can be converted to solve problems in your neighborhood, then they do. And if they are not appropriate for that situation, then they don't. And so our technology for melee weapons has actually, to a certain extent, it's more advanced because we have access to more modern materials. To another extent, it's sort of regressed because we're not using melee weapons that are designed to have long effective reach mm-hmm. anymore.
It's close quarter
because that's not right. And so it's things that are knives or like knives is what modern soldiers have to carry. And so in order to have a military need for a weapon that has that level of lethality at melee range, we're going to need to exist in a world where the effectiveness of ballistics is made irrelevant.
Yeah, because in the lore of Star Wars, the lightsabers were mostly, I mean, yes, of course, they were used offensively, but they were also used defensively. And especially when tied in
right.
with the Force, they could deflect bullets. They can deflect other lightsabers too, you know, but...
And they make like ranged attack substantially less effective, mm-hmm. right? Like that's one of the powers of them. And so, you know, if we end up in a position where there's a technology, whether it's an armor or, you know, something that makes it to where, you know, bullets and missiles are no longer the most effective way to take someone's life, then, you know, then there creates this need for a weapon that's used close quarters that can negate that armor. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, that's one of the situations that would lead us there. You know, and some sort of, I don't know what an industrial application of such a cutter would be.
I'm sorry. What? You're focused on, like, no one cares about the industrial. Well, but so this is, we just care that it looks cool.
Well, yeah, but the people that are going to have the enough money in R&D, right, to make this happen, because this is not going to be an inexpensive venture.
We're not plasma CNC milling, you know, pieces of you know, metal, like, here.
We'd, exactly.
More effective, more cheaper ways of doing so.
Right. And so it's like, and so that sort of, if there becomes a situation where, like, something that looks like a lightsaber solves an industrial problem more efficiently than what we're currently doing, that'll get us there too.
So what you're saying is, right? we need to come up with a solution or situation, rather, that is so convoluted, so complex, that we have to force people to.
That it's the only way to solve it.
Okay.
Right. And it becomes the only way to solve it, but also that the money is worth it. So, like, maybe if giant robot combat becomes the way that disputes are resolved in the world, mm-hmm. like, maybe that gets us there.
A lot of my fellow Transformer fans may agree with you on that.
Exactly. Beam sword. I'm about that. That'd be awesome.
Beam swords. Let's do this.
It's like, maybe that's how we do it. Maybe that's how we get lightsabers.
I think it's interesting that you did mention about materials that could potentially be resistant to those sorts of situations. Because like everything, the lightsaber is not the perfect weapon. And in the lore, there were even materials that had to be developed that were, you know, both artificial and even naturally found to resist a lightsaber blow. Most famously, the Beskar, which is, you know, we started this podcast talking about the show The Mandalorian and the lore behind Mandalore and their use of Beskar. There was even that one episode of The Clone Wars where they found the Zillow Beast. You know, so there were even creatures that were resistant to lightsaber. And even the Praetorian Guard, the ones who protected the Emperor.
The armor that was, it was sturdy enough to withstand lightsaber blows. So you had to put oomph behind it mm-hmm. in order to, you know, remove appendages as a lightsaber is expected to do.
Yeah.
So the awesomeness of a lightsaber is its deadliness and its power and its effectiveness and the fact that it solves so many problems. Like
a locked door.
You know, like in Right, Qui-Gon's like, oh, they closed the blast door. Okay, well, I'm just going to need to plunge this in a little deeper. You know, like, problem solving. And this is gonna take longer, but it's still gonna work.
Problem. So I'm you know, like surprised that he didn't use the trope that we also find in Star Wars, like, oh, the door is closed, let me open it by blasting the lock open. Or no, the door is open, let me lock it by shooting the blast door
and then shooting it close. Yeah.
I think Qui-Gon's problem is that he didn't have enough blasters.
Right, and how frustrating would it be to be an engineer in the Star Wars universe? God. Because there are so many problems that it's just like, oh, I can't fix this. Bang. Yeah. Or you're having to plan for somebody's ability to do magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To prevent them from doing something that you don't want them to do, and you can't because the magic lets them do it.
Exactly.
Like, you know, like that.
It's as small as we can. It's no bigger than a womp rat, and you're gonna blame me? You're gonna blame me as a structural flaw? Nah, space wizards.
It's an exhaust port. There is stuff going out of it.
I remember that clip. Like, you can't blame such a me great, for like, space wizards, okay?
Such a wonderful name. But that, you know, and so having, from a storyteller standpoint, having something that can either protect a character from a lightsaber, because you want them to be able to go knuckles and jawbones with a Jedi and not just get turned into spaghetti, or you know, because you have you want to be able to present a Jedi with a credible threat that is interesting. Mm-hmm. Right, so like one of the problems that we have in the prequels is that, like, the battle droids, like, they work in number, it's understandable why a whole bunch of them are a problem and things like mm-hmm. that, but Jedi are able to mow through them like they are plants. Like, they might as well be crops.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like, and so then that, as a viewer, it makes it so that the threat of those battle droids is sort of diminished because of how easy it can be for our hero to kill a bunch of them.
I think there was both in the original animated Clone Wars and then the 3D version of Clone Wars series, in both instances, Mace Windu was... he's portrayed as just completely cutting them down, like you said, like crops, like wheat with a sickle.
I think they might as well be corn. Yeah,
exactly. There was a line that I remember. He stops and they infiltrate this location with Anakin Skywalker, and he goes on this speech with, like, I have bested 9,000 versions of you B1 battle droids. Lay down your arms and peacefully surrender. And then they look at each other. I'm like, blast them. And then he looks at Anakin and I'm like, well, I tried, you know.
I gave him the choice. When the Jedi go to confront Palpatine in his office, and you know, he does the dark side screech and he flips over his desk, and then he just
the dark side corkscrew.
Yeah, like, but then he, like, you know, he dusts three Jedi, like, just boom, 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 and then it's over, right? Like, Kit Fisto goes down. And so, like, when we first saw that, we didn't know any of those Jedi from the TV show, not really. At least most viewers didn't. And so we didn't get the impression, oh, man, Palpatine's really good. Yeah. We got the impression, oh, man, those Jedi were chumps.
Yeah. No, I'm glad we got that. And that was that sort of novelization and in the animated shows, we were able to get that background
and it made us appreciate those characters more, right? But then this creates the problem for storytelling, is that the lightsaber solves so many problems so easy,
right?
And so then having materials that make it harder, like Beskar or like the Praetorian Guard's armor, so like, I, not to dive back into The Last Jedi and our, you know, our different perspectives there, but like, the Praetorian Guards present the most optimal lightsaber fight for me personally.
Oh no, I'll agree with you. That was a great fight. That was a great scene.
Well, and like, you have villains that present a credible threat in terms of offensive ability, but not so high that it's a one-on-one equal, but there's more of them.
Yeah.
And so you have this group of them that are able to be lethal, and they are survivable enough that they don't look like chumps when they get dropped.
Yeah.
And so it's this, like, they're able to present a credible threat in, like, okay, they have numbers and they can survive, like, light hits. You have to really get them and this stuff. So it makes it so that the fight scene has it keeps you on the edge a little bit more than like some of the other lightsaber fights that we've had aren't able to give us that same level of worry about what's going to happen. You know, like when Jedi are fighting battle droids, we're not ever really worried about the Jedi. Now, one of the other problems the prequels have is because we've already seen the original trilogy, we know that Obi-Wan's not going to die. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, it's like, so there's a level of credible threat that is just like, well, I know how this is going to go. Like, I know, you know, there's not a suspense because I know what's going to
happen. Yeah. It's like, we know these are good guys. We know these are the bad guys, and the bad guys aren't really, you know, they're not that strong or whatever, but then we have to be told that there are other bad guys in the background sort of, you know, moving things along and stringing things along and being the puppet masters behind
it. You know, so like that, I'm hopeful that in the new, like the High Republic stories, I've only gotten to read one of the comic books so far and things like that. I'm hopeful that they're going to be able to continue to give us that where there's like, you know, sort of credible foil to the Jedi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so far we're doing it without the Sith is how it's sort of set up. So then it's like, look, this could be really, really interesting.
Heard some of the writers, they've been asked, you know, what's the threat? And the way that they have to frame it when they're writing is what could possibly scare the Jedi? You know, this, like you said, the Sith isn't going to be around again until the events of the Republic, of the New Republic. I'm sorry. Not the New Republic, but the events of, you know, like
the prequels.
Exactly. Yeah. So what could possibly scare the Jedi? And it's something that has to be absolutely so chaotic because it is the antithesis to what they are, which is order.
Order, peace, calm.
Speaking of High Republic, I had noticed a couple of things. First, the designs of the lightsabers that they introduced in the concept art. They're absolutely beautiful. Very, you know,
awesome.
Compared to what we've seen in the movies, are, you know, the ones in the movies are very simple in design in comparison. But these are like very ornate. They almost look like medieval, not in the sense that they're primitive, but they have a lot of flair to them.
Yeah, they look sort of inspired, like almost Lord of the Rings inspired, kind of. I'm a fan. I'm such a fan.
Something else that I saw is the ships that they used to get around compared to the ones that they used as personal fighters in the Clone Wars were very sleek, very nimble. They had no weapons, and the only way that you can activate it was with a push to start mechanism by using your own lightsaber.
And which is a really interesting, they've come up with some really interesting and compelling storytelling ways to make it so that Jedi are not easy buttons.
Yeah.
And that's something I really appreciate. Cause like spoiler alert, the last episode of Mandalorian, where like we watched Djarin use everything he had in a fight against one dark trooper, and it was like he didn't actually win, not really, right? Like he barely won. And then Luke wades through them,
right?
Like, you know, and we're basically shown how dangerous they are, and then it makes us appreciate just how much of a badass, you know, immediately post Return of the Jedi Luke is, like how, you know, like what that level of desolation can be. You know, and so like we understand how much of an easy button like Vader in the hallway in Rogue One, Luke against, you know, it's like we understand how much of an easy button they can be. And so finding ways
to the Jedi, you know, now we have a new opportunity to see that.
Yeah, and make them interesting so then we can connect with them and empathize with them. So that instead of being, you know, sort of deified figures, they can be it's easier to sort of connect and things like that, which I'm really excited about.
Speaking of speaking of Mandalorian, I don't know if you got a minute, like I want to talk about the Darksaber and how I mean, we can go into a whole dissertation on that. I'm fascinated with the Darksaber and has deep lore in the Mandalorian culture. It was the only one of its kind used in the Jedi Order. But now that it's sort of resurfaced itself in this weird period of time that's post Empire, but you know, pre Force Awakens, what are your thoughts? Where do you think the direction of the Mandalorian is going to go now that the Darksaber has one revealed itself? I mean, it's been revealed, but two, you know, how do you think this is going to play out with the new franchises and the next season of the Mandalorian?
And so we've got a new season of Mandalorian that it looks like a key piece of the conflict is going to be Bo-Katan's goals.
Yeah. Speaking of which, let me put on my Bo-Katan, my Bo-Katan headband when we talk about this.
Perfect. I've seen a lot of people, like there's a lot of memes that surfaced about, like, you know, when we first meet Bo-Katan, she doesn't take her helmet off because that's a backwards philosophical thing. But then when presented with the opportunity to just accept the Darksaber, like, you know, she has this hang up. There's a lot of people that have sort of memed that in various forms. I actually really appreciate that. I thought that was really great. Cause like what the Darksaber represents, the reason why the holder of the Darksaber is the ruler of Mandalore is, if you can't be given that, you have to take it. And so if you are going to be in charge,
you have to earn that right.
You can't be given it. You have to be universally acknowledged as the best. And you can't be given the title the best. You have to take it. And the person that used to be the best, they can't give it to you. Because if they give it to you, they're still the best. And that, like, so like that aspect of it and that conflict, which Djarin has absolutely no interest in being involved
exactly.
in. Exactly. Which is like, which is fun.
Because it's like, because there's to that meme, it's like, nobody's going to know. They're going to know. Nobody's going to know. Oh my God.
The hero story that we are used to in Star Wars, and this is one of the things that the Mandalorian has sort of subverted in a way that I've really enjoyed, is like the hero story is nobody else can do this. This needs to be done. I am going to do it. Like that's the hero.
Yeah.
That's Rey. That's Luke. That's Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
Like nobody else can do this. I am going
to
do it.
I've been holding on to
and
this.
And Djarin is just like,
yeah, I've been holding on to this theory that it's a very Prince and Pauper kind of storyline with Din Djarin. He doesn't care. He holds to the creed and he has that sense of honor, and his sense of honor has been building. But towards the end of The Mandalorian, the particulars of his creed have been challenged, and he's broken them for the sake of someone that he loved, which means that he's going to be going off not in a completely different direction, but in a more stronger positive direction from this point forward. The theory that I've been holding is that the title card, The Mandalorian, were more than just talking about this particular Mandalorian, Din Djarin. I feel like he will be the Mandalorian, as in he will be the ruler of Mandalore. And that this is just, you know, part two of three of that journey.
Right. You know, because like, season three, like the culminating act could be him accepting the throne after trying to turn it away. Like there's shades of Aragorn, right? Like there's sort of that story arc.
There's a lot of Lord of the Rings references here. Only Mike will know that. The running joke is I've never read any of the books and I know nothing about it. So, but I do acknowledge that there's a lot of these elements pulled from that. I don't see it as him doing it as soon as season three opens. But possibly towards the end.
I mean, that might be the culminating act, right? Like that might be what the story of season three is about. Maybe. Is him having to accept the crown, even though he doesn't want it.
Yeah. And that's
because,
you know,
and that's the opposite of, like, if you look at Anakin's story arc, right? So Anakin's arc is, and cause this has been memed to hell. He loved the girl until he wanted power, and then his desire for that power was greater than his love for, you know, like, and so that duality. So like he chose the pursuit of power, right? And in the case of Djarin, it's entirely possible he's going to be in this position where he doesn't want the power
versus someone he's like
actively trying to not have
versus
it.
Versus someone like Bo-Katan, who obviously does want the power. Her
strongly motivated,
incredibly motivated. We don't know if her motivations are noble or not. We do know what her, you know, she wants to free Mandalore, but she's also the type of person that's like, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get to that point. She's the Yang that you referred to before.
We know she's comfortable with the ends justify the means. We know she's comfortable with that.
That's for sure. I mean, we forget she was a terrorist at one point, but you know, we won't go into that. We won't go into that.
Indeed. That's another episode.
Yeah, I find it, but the, funny like that the Jaren, this, that this struggle is happening between these non-Jedi versus the Jedi. It was a part of their culture. It was a part of the self. And versus Mandalorians, they're like, I don't care about no Darksaber. You know, I don't care. As long as one person has it, and as long as it's not me, I'm fine. And then we see this conflict
that hero journey.
Yeah.
It's there's shades of Spider-Man there. Right. Like, you know, it's like there's a lot of hero archetypes. There's people that we really love that like, they don't want it, but nobody else can do it. So they begrudgingly do it, even though they kind of hate it.
With great power comes, you know, great responsibility. Like,
that helps us empathize with those characters. Cause there's like, cause on one hand, like, I had an English teacher in high school that said this. Does anybody know what the best part of being Batman is? You get to be Batman. Does anybody know what the worst part of being Batman is? You have to be Batman.
I was going to say dead parents, but yeah, that works.
But yeah. Like that, but that it's like that, but that like, cause there's the, like, there's all this stuff that comes with it. That's really good.
And there's a lot of baggage associated.
And there's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that like, cause once you do that, once you convert yourself into an icon for whatever reason, there's a weight that like, you know, that can't easily be handed off. Cause if you hand it off, if it doesn't get taken from you, then you're not the best.
Yeah. Like, you know, like it has to be earned. You have to show that you have the right to be able to wield it. Right. You got, how much time you got? You got to go? Do you want?
I should go.
Okay, let's do final.
Sorry.
We'll do final thoughts. Absolutely. So what is, okay, I want to edit this out. So Alan, thanks a lot for being on the show with us and talking about not just lightsabers, but also the aspects of martial arts that revolve around the lore and the application of lightsabers in the Star Wars universe. Is there anything in particular that you want to recap on, or anything that you appreciate about today's discussion?
This was a lot of fun. And being invited to talk about Star Wars with somebody that only sort of tertiary knows me, but you know, has the faith that, you know, I'll make for interesting discussion is really special. That's been really cool. I should be plugging my business and all that kind of stuff, but like, you know, if you want saber training, level up lightsaber, here we are.
Well, I'm going to ask you to plug your lightsaber. It's the least I can do. So actually,
if I was business motivated, then that would be the, like, here's what I'm here to do. But like, this
but you're a great example.
It's interesting to talk about Star Wars, and like, it's been, it's fun.